From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's harvest time in the Corn Belt, and this year's crop may well be the largest America has ever seen. Corn is big these days, never bigger. A new documentary takes us to the heart of corn country and asks us where it's taking the nation. Our guides, two young, fresh out of college guys, first find out in a science lab what they, and probably you, are made of.
Well, I've analyzed your hair, and the real conclusion is that the carbon in your bodies is really originates from corn.
Corn in their hair, corn in the grocery store, corn in our soda and ice cream and bacon and burgers. They get obsessed. They head to Iowa with a proposal for farm owner Chuck Pyatt.
We recently learned that people who grew up eating the way we did are basically made out of corn. What the heck? We're writing with a strange proposal. We want to move to Iowa and plant a single acre of corn on your land.
This hour on Point, we look at a new documentary, King Corn, and the deep impact of America's mightiest grain. You can join the conversation from field to feedlot to corn syrup to waistline. How do you weigh the impact of America's super crop? Is it a blessing, or have we taken a good grain and made it into a monster? We're at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We will hear in this hour from Iowa farmers and ag economists. We begin in New York with Ian Chaney. He's writer, co-producer, and co-star of the new documentary King Corn. He and his best friend from college, Kurt Ellis, go in search of America's great and sometimes disturbing corn story. The Austin Chronicle calls the film as relevant as Super Size Me and as important as An Inconvenient Truth in the recent rash of documentaries that challenge our perceptions of daily life in America. Ian Chaney, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
So here we are in the middle of a corn boom. Corn prices way up. Biggest corn harvest in history. Corn farmers finally catch a break, and you guys come along to what? Kick down their happy moment?
Yeah, you know, we never set out to say anything bad about corn. We simply set out to learn where our food came from. So graduating college and reading ingredient labels, this same four-letter word kept appearing, and with the realization that our great-grandfathers had both come from corn country, we thought it was a pretty reasonable idea to pack up the gray pickup truck and drive to the Midwest, where we'd never lived, and see how corn could have gotten into our hair. And, you know, growing up, corn was always a beautiful crop that appeared on our 4th of July dinner tables. And so the very idea that corn might be making America fat was a pretty surprising one to stumble across.
You know, there are a lot of comparisons in your PR materials to Michael Moore's Sicko and Super Size Me. But I have to say right off the bat, and I'm a corn country kid, a Midwest kid by birth and by upbringing. There's actually a lot of love in this film for the arena, the part of the country that you end up looking awfully hard at. You both, as you say, ended up finding you had great-grandfathers there in Iowa who had been involved in agriculture very intimately. And your 1 acre of corn in that big ocean, well, there's love in the filming as well as a big critique.
Yeah, well, we loved living in Iowa, and we were really warmly welcomed by the people in green, Chuck Pyatt, the farmer who took a leap and leased us an acre of corn in the middle of a 700-acre corn patch, and also by our families there. So it wasn't hard to develop a real affection for that place, and that made it even more complicated as we wanted to try and kind of tease out the ways in which corn might be causing some problems, because we became very proud of our acre and we became very proud of all that our families had done in their kind of path to, well, I guess I should back up. Kurt's family had helped develop the tractor, and so are
right, very early on, one of the very earliest versions of the tractor, the Oliver and that ilk, his great-granddad was right in there.
Exactly. So, and my great-grandfather grew up on a corn farm and later helped to make aerial maps of farmland. And so our families are embedded in the history of this place. And so our acre of corn was in part made possible by our own families. So in that sense, we felt a sense of ownership over the acre and over the crop that we were growing.
And yet there's a big lament in this documentary. What's the heart of the problem, Ian?
Well, the heart of the problem is that we ended up becoming very disappointed in our acre of corn. What we were growing was essentially a nutritionless raw material for America's fast food restaurants. Our acre of corn, over half of it goes to feed livestock, largely cattle. And corn is like a fast food for cattle. It makes them fat very quickly. And corn-fed beef is a lot fattier than grass-fed beef. And yet that's the beef that is ubiquitous in America today, and especially, in the 99-cent hamburger. Another big chunk of our corn crop ended up being transformed through semi-magical processes into high fructose corn syrup, which is the ubiquitous sweetener in the United States. So when we followed our beloved acre out into the world, we came to see that what we were growing was junk food, and it wasn't hard to make the leap from America's huge corn harvests to America's huge wastelines.
You found huge wastelines and the obesity and diabetes that can come along with that. You also found a changing terrain in Iowa, family farms really under pressure from bigger and bigger farmers, changing that kind of mythical landscape of corn country that we think of. Here's a little clip from King Corn describing how the age of small family farms is disappearing. Here you and your buddy Kurt talk with Elna Kleichman about how things have changed in Iowa.
Today, it's not uncommon for a single farmer in Greene to work 1,000 acres. And what smaller farms remain are getting consolidated into still larger operations.
There's, an awful lot of farmsteads that are just plain disappearing. You go down the road here, and while there used to be the Kroll place, there used to be the Marzins, there's just so many of the homesteads that are gone.
Corn again.
Get all the housing out of Floyd County, it makes them easier for them to farm it, because then you don't have all these little houses and stuff in the way.
Get all the housing out of the way, and it's easier to farm it. Ian Cheney and his buddy Kurt Ellis found industrial-scale farming in Iowa, though a lot of good people making a living there, and a better living recently than in a long time, with corn prices over the moon on ethanol and all the rest. They see a path to high fructose corn syrup, soda pop, fast food, big waistlines, and diabetes. Let's talk to an Iowa farmer. George Naylor joins us from Sherdan, Iowa. He was born and raised in Iowa, been farming same family land for 31 years. He's president of the National Family Farm Coalition. He's got 470 acres of corn and soybeans scheduled to begin his corn harvest today. George Naylor, thanks very much for being with us.
Yeah, hi, Tom. It's good to be here.
So you're going to be out on your corn harvest, your corn picker soon today.
Yeah, on my combine.
Ian Cheney and Kurt Ellis came out to corn country, farmed one puny little acre, and came away with real mixed feelings about corn these days. As a corn farmer, how are you feeling? Prices are high, ethanol's got the big boom, demand is way up. Are you feeling good?
Well, it feels a lot better to get a little over $3 a bushel for corn than it does less than $2 a bushel, let me tell you. But let me address that question of whether the price of corn is high or not. Shortly after I started farming, I became a member of the first Iowa Corn Promotion Board, which was a agribusiness organization, actually, that intended to give a reason to get rid of farm programs and to let the market set our prices, which was, a real disaster, and that's been the path we've been on for many years.
Farm programs, as in the big government subsidies to corn farmers, among others.
No, that's another myth about that, okay, but that's another question. The point is that in 1978, the average national price of corn was $2.25 a bushel.
Mm-hmm.
And if you adjust that for inflation, the price of corn would be today $7 a bushel. Okay, that's what a farm program was supposed to do all mm-hmm. these years, adjust the actual market price of corn. Okay, and if the price of corn was $7 a bushel today, people wouldn't be thinking about turning corn into ethanol or corn sweeteners or feeding livestock in great big huge animal confinements.
So what are you saying there? Is the government not subsidizing enough or somehow has the market captive through its food programs?
Well, there has to be a clear distinction between subsidizing a crop and having a price support and regulating the supply. The intention of a farm program was to actually to support the price, just like a minimum wage says that if you want to hire somebody, you have to pay a minimum wage. Well, with a good farm program, the good farm program would be saying to ADM and Cargill and these great big companies that you would have to pay $7 a bushel for corn, and we will help the farmer not abuse the land so that they don't have to produce so much corn in the first place.
Do you think you're abusing the land now, where Iowa farmers are in general?
Well, yes, and that's because of the insecurity of farmers economically. They have no choice but to try to produce as much corn as they possibly can.
More American land in corn this year than any time since World War II. Ian Cheney is part of a new documentary called King Corn. We'll hear more about it. George Naylor, Iowa farmer, is with us as well. You can join the conversation. What does it mean that even our hair is loaded with corn? Is it too much of a good thing, or on we go? 800-423-8255 is our number. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the deep impact of America's mightiest grain, corn, on our diets, our health, our gas tanks, our land. King Corn is the new documentary premiering this weekend. Ian Cheney is with us. He's writer and co-producer, 27 years old, went out in 2003 to farm 1 acre of corn in the middle of the corn ocean in Iowa, learned a lot along the way, made a documentary that's not as snarky as Michael Moore, but it actually conveys a lot of beauty of that Iowa landscape and the people who farm it. But at the end of the show, you're really thinking twice about just how huge corn has become, certainly in our food supply. You can join the conversation. What do you think? From Coke to steak to candy to everything in your Happy Meal, does anything not come from corn these days? What does it mean to live in the land of King Corn? Do you see a price to being the corn-fed nation? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Ian Cheney joins us from New York. George Naylor, Iowa farmer, joins us from Chardin, Iowa, farms 470 acres there. Let's get a call right now from Dean in Fairfield, Iowa. Hi, Dean, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Good morning. I just had a comment about the nature of the corn that we're growing these days. I do believe it's about 87% of the corn crop in Iowa and in the Midwest total is actually genetically engineered corn. It's not the corn that these guys, grandfathers and great-grandfathers, were involved in growing and producing. The problem with that is that Europe is rejecting this corn. There's African countries rejecting this corn. Asia's rejecting this corn. They don't want genetically engineered corn. And so we're forced, or our policymakers are basically deciding that we'll still cram this food down our throats by putting it in everything. That's one of the reasons it's showing up in our soft drinks and every type of food that we're consuming, is because no one else wants this stuff. And in their wisdom, our government is mandating that this stuff is not labeled, because they're afraid that if the people knew that it was genetically engineered, that out of our ignorance of what genetically engineered food was, we would not consume it.
But, Dean, look around you there in Iowa. You're in a state that depends in a huge way on exactly this crop, and a lot of people put a lot of effort into growing it.
Well, the fact of the matter is it's being forced down our throats, because this is a genetically engineered crop that if you look at the polls, if people were asked, people want this stuff labeled. If it was labeled, they wouldn't be consuming it. We have a policy in place that allows this product that nobody wants to consume. Europeans don't want it. Africans don't want it.
Yeah.
Asians don't want it. And we are sneaking it into our food supply so that we can produce this stuff.
Dean, we've got it. And we thank you very much for that call from Fairfield. Ian Cheney, what about it? What did you learn about the corn that's being planted and why?
We planted a genetically modified corn. We wanted to grow corn like everybody else in town. And our corn had been genetically modified to resist the effects of an extremely powerful herbicide that's called Liberty. Mm-hmm. And so we sprayed Liberty over everything, and everything dies except our corn.
That's the point. You know, that's the idea, right, of the genetic modification.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah, and the point of that is the same as using a lot of fertilizer on our acre, which is to grow as much corn as we possibly can. So, in that sense, genetic modification is just in the cornfield is just making a bigger and bigger pile of corn. And I think the question that we really need to answer is, why do we need that enormous pile of corn, and is that really doing us any good?
Your great-grandfathers might have raised 40 bushels, got 40 bushels to an acre of corn. You got about 180, and 200 is not unheard of these days. We have an enormous crop. George Naylor, I want to ask you about something that one couple that Ian and Kurt talked to said about their corn crop in Iowa. Here they are, talking with Don and Elna Kleichman right before the harvest about the corn they're about to bring in.
I think our problem is figuring out what we want to do with it once we harvest it, because we've been out figuring out where it could go, and none of our options seem particularly attractive. And I'm not terribly impressed.
And you shouldn't be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Should be impressed at the stupidity. We aren't growing quality. We're growing crap. Poorest quality crop the world's ever seen. We're growing it today.
You don't eat the corn that you grow?
No.
Not saying that I might not grind up a little bit for some cornmeal, but I basically don't.
I don't necessarily grow my corn for food. I don't care what's done with it. I'm selling it. It's bottom line.
George Naylor, that is very, very tough language. Poorest quality the world's ever seen. Do you share that feeling about what you're growing in your 470 acres?
Well, I've chosen not to raise genetically modified crops, and I think I've not been hurt economically by that up to this point. But the more that the big corporations monopolize the seed supply, the more I will be put in a corner. But the thing is that I think that people need to realize that farmers out here now are just producing protein, carbohydrates, and oil, nothing more. And that's all we get paid for. So we're going to produce as much of those three items as we possibly can, no matter what kind of crop we have to raise to do it and or how we do it, because we are economically insecure. Let me give you a statistic from an economist in Minnesota. His name's Ken Meter.
Yes, please.
He studied eight counties in northeast Iowa. From 1999 to 2003, those counties sold $1.08 billion worth of crops per year on average, they spent $1.14 billion every year to produce it. So they lost $62 million every year during those years, and that's even taking into account the fact that the farmers received $173 million per year in government crop payments. Okay. So the point is that even with the government payments, farmers have been raped as economically through the years, and they have no choice to produce anything else. You can't think of what it would be. In 2005, there were 266 million acres of program crops. That's basically corn, soybeans, wheat, and other oil seeds. Yeah. But only 12 million acres of fruits and vegetables. Okay, and the reason that farmers aren't going to produce anything but corn and soybeans and wheat and those kinds of crops is because there are no markets for anything else, and the livestock industry has been moved off of the family farm into huge feedlots because they can buy cheap corn and soybean meal. So it all reverts back to a lack of policy that says that we're going to price farm products that really truly reflect the total cost of producing them.
And instead, we get an enormous volume of corn and a price that you say, even now, when it's gone up a lot in straight dollar terms is not near where it ought to be.
No, it's very cheap, yeah. And so, once again, farmers are just stuck with the alternative of producing quantity and not quality, because that's really all they're getting paid for.
Farmer George Naylor in Sherdan, Iowa, thanks very much for being with us today, Mr. Naylor.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
Let me take a call from John in Newburyport, Massachusetts. John, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you? Nice to talk with you today. I have a comment about the connection between agribusiness and oil in the United States. It seems to me that what's happened is that large businesses, the big business guys, not necessarily the farmer you were just talking with, have created a dependency on corn by feeding, you know, changing the diet of cattle, of beef, from a grass-based diet to one of corn, and then the ramifications of that, which Michael Pollan talked so eloquently about in an essay about 10 years ago, about how antibiotics have to be administered because this diet is so foreign to cows.
Yeah, so?
But also how there's corn syrup in basically everything we eat. I try to eat very carefully and try to think about limiting sugar for my kids, but it's almost as if it's permeated everything in our diets. And I think there is really a connection between the lobbyists who protect the interests of oil and the lobbyists who protect agribusiness. You know, ethanol is this kind of is being promoted as this cure-all for our energy problems, and I think all it really does is prevent genuine alternative energy research.
John, we've got it. There's another skeptical eye cocked on oil, on corn, even when a lot of people are looking at corn to really help out on the energy front, at least in terms of feeding those all those ethanol distilleries that have been built there. Thanks for your call. Ian Cheney, if I may, I'd like to bring a couple more voices into this conversation. With us from Battle Creek, Michigan, is Ricardo Salvador, an expert on corn, looks closely at sustainability, former professor of agronomy at Iowa State University. Ricardo Salvador, thanks very much for being here.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
And with us as well from Knoxville, Tennessee, Daryl Ray, director of the Agricultural Policy Analysis Center at the University of Tennessee, grew up on a farm in Iowa. His siblings both still farm 1,000-plus acre farms in Iowa. Daryl Ray, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Tom. It's a pleasure.
Daryl Ray, let me come first to you. You followed corn for a long time and grew up surrounded by a lot of it. You've seen Ian and Kurt's documentary. What do you take of the message that they've taken away from this, which is basically that there's just too much, too cheap, and it's invading too many parts of the American food system and economy? What do you say to that?
I think that there's a lot to be said for the story that they're telling. As George said, there has been a shift change in agricultural policy over the years, and that shift has been to producing as much as you can, and if the prices fall, well, then you backfill with government payments. And that has made it possible for those that buy corn to buy it below the cost of production. And when you have that kind of a situation, why, it allows you to expand your use of the ingredient. So in some sense, farmers are kind of passing along the subsidies to the people that are demanding and using the corn, which is not really the way it's presented, but it's really those integrators and other users of corn that are really being subsidized.
Ian Cheney, you note in the film that it wasn't always this way, that American agricultural policy for a long time sort of balanced the output of corn until the early 1970s when Secretary of Agriculture Earl Butz came along and said, fence row to fence row, we're going for all-out volume here. What was the impact of that?
Well, the impact has been a really kind of thickening stream of corn coming out of the Midwest and enabling pretty new ways of dealing with that corn. One of them is the high fructose corn syrup industry, which really emerged around that time, around 1970.
Coke and Pepsi didn't used to use corn syrup in their drinks. Of course, they do now, not only them.
Right. As the representative of the corn syrup industry points out in our film, corn syrup is a very easy to use, cheap sweetener. You can just unload it from a tanker with a hose right into your big batch of soda. So it became a ubiquitous sweetener, largely because it was so cheap and there was so much corn to ensure the supply of that sweetener. And the other part of the story is, I think George mentioned, is the growing prevalence of big feedlots and confined feeding operations. Because corn is was so cheap as the supply increased, it became this the obvious feed to give to cattle in particular, because it makes them fat so much more quickly that a rancher can churn out corn-fed beef to the market much more quickly than if they were raising them on grass, which is what cows are meant to eat.
We're going to cut away right here, as we do every day at just this time. And I should say, you know, what we cut away for here is the Iowa Crop Report, the Farm Report, where all those prices of corn and hog bellies and everything else get delivered. It is huge business. We're looking at the impact of the corn side of it today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Ricardo Salvador, you're there in Battle Creek, Michigan, at the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, Program Director of Food Systems and Rural Development there. I don't know if that gives you a conflicted interest in this story or not, but what do you make of the way that corn's place in the American food system, just for starters, and we'll look at energy, but in the American food system has evolved? Is it good? Is it good for agriculture? Is it good for American health? Is it sustainable?
So I'll answer that last question first and say that it isn't sustainable, and then let me go back to the first part of your question. Mm-hmm. We really, I think, need to take a look at the bigger picture. At the top of the hour, you had a very intriguing question, which is whether corn was a good grain or whether it's been turned into a monster. And I think in the big picture, the thing to remember is that this is, in fact, just a grain. And that what we are seeing documented very well in the film King Corn is really an industrialized food system. In other words, the processes of industries that developed and were applied so well in other spheres of human activity now applied to the food system. Mm-hmm. And to understand that big picture very briefly, it is well to know that the people that put this in place had very clear objectives that were formulated at a time when everyone didn't know exactly where their next meal was going to come from. Mm-hmm. And they put into place a system that essentially arranges resources from around the world. Energy is one that you want to talk about, but also materials, and causes them to flow in such a way that edible bites can be assembled such that the rest of us don't need to know where our food is going to come from. We just need to get hungry, and within minutes of having the thought, satisfy that hunger. So we have been successful spectacularly beyond belief in the span of half a century, mm. going from a system where people really did have to spend a significant amount of their time in the now industrialized countries thinking about where their food was going to come from and how to assemble it, to that world now where you can step out of your door without a care about your food. Just know that wherever you are, whatever you want to eat, whether it's in season or not, whether it's produced where you live or not, you can have what you want just because you desire it, as long as you can pay for it.
Is corn the culprit in that story, or does that have many legs to that stool?
There are many legs to that stool, but I raise that as the big picture because corn is probably one of the very best manifestations of that, and it actually is one of the key enablers of that sort of system.
Ian Cheney, you were right there in the thick of it. I mean, a lot of people are putting a lot of effort into bringing out that crop. Did you end up completely disenchanted? Is there a place for it? Do you want to, I don't know, tear up the crop rotation, the crop program, and start all over?
That's a good question. I'm not sure whether you're asking what the solution is, and I'm far too young to know what the solution might be, because I think there are probably many solutions, but we ended up feeling like we might have been better off if we hadn't raised that acre of corn at all. After seeing where it ended up, we felt that we felt kind of bad about the idea that our 10,000 pounds of corn were going out into the world to make soda pop, to be distributed at a school vending machine or heaven knows where. And so in that sense, I think there does need to be some really some hard thinking about what we're growing and what we're putting so much energy into growing and so many tax dollars into growing.
We'll come back and do some of that hard thinking right here. Ian Chaney, co-producer of King Corn, is with us. Daryl Ray is with us from Knoxville, Tennessee, and Ricardo Salvador from Battle Creek, Michigan. You can join us as well. Has government policy encouraged the growth of too much corn? We're at 800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the deep impact of America's mightiest grain, corn, on our diets, our health, our gas tanks, our land. Ian Chaney's with us. He's co-producer with Kurt Ellis of and Aaron Wolf of the new documentary, King Corn, premiering this weekend in New York first and then on around the country. It's a big look at corn in Iowa. They raised 1 acre, peanuts, and learned a lot out of that. Also with us, Ricardo Salvador from Battle Creek, Michigan at the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, former professor of agronomy at Iowa State University. He looks at corn and human sustainability. Daryl Ray is with us from Knoxville, Tennessee, director of ag policy analysis at the University of Tennessee. Grew up on an Iowa farm, has a brother and sister still farming there. You can join us. What do you think? Have we taken a good grain and made it into a monster somehow? Is corn's hyperabundance force-feeding it into every corner of our food supply? Is that a good thing or not? And what's your takeaway from Ian Chaney's Corn Country Homecoming and message? Is he on to a problem or making a good grain look bad? We're at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. The documentary points all the way back to 1973 when Earl Butz, Secretary of Agriculture under Presidents Nixon and Ford, talked about his big mission.
What we want out of agriculture is plenty of food. And that's our drive now. This year, 1973, we're going to see the most massive increase in production of farm products ever in the history of this country. And next year we're going for a still further increase on top of that as we pull all stops.
Earl Butz called for it and he got it. More corn in production this year than ever since World War II. That has implications. Ian Chaney and Kurt Ellis talked with Alan Trinkle at Iowa State University about feedlot cattle and the use of corn feed.
A lot of people look at these large feedlots now and question whether that's what we should be doing. But the reason that it's done, it's economic. And because of the yields on corn and the amount produced and the efficiency of producing corn, it's lower cost per unit of usable energy to the animal.
Clip there from King Corn. Ian Chaney is with us today, along with Ricardo Salvador and Daryl Ray. Right now, Don is calling from Palo, Iowa. Hi, Don. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Really love your show.
Thank you.
A lot of corn bashing going on here this morning.
Yes.
I guess there's so many points to make. I'm not supposed to make them all, but I guess I'll make two quick ones. Number one, the high fructose corn syrup. Basically, it's a replacement because of it's a lower cost. And some people realize there's going to be sugar in their soda pop if there isn't high fructose corn syrup.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the ethanol front, there's a lot of bashing about that's not the direction to go. But I think we have to look at alternative fuels as a process or a stepping stone, and ethanol is the first one in that. I don't think it causes any less research. If anything, I think it'll jumpstart the research. And in 10 years, ethanol may not be used, but right now we have a glut of corn at a very low price, even at $3, and I could get started on the food prices going up and
right.
The very little amount of corn being used in that food. Basically, it's your processors that are trying to make a windfall on this, not the farmer.
Don, let me ask you, what's your relationship to corn, Don?
I'm combining corn right now.
You're in the combine, in the field?
Yes, I am.
And so when Ian Chaney points and Kurt Ellis point to problems to maybe an overabundance, do you feel part of a problem or part of a solution?
Well, I think earlier, 5 years ago, maybe I thought I was part of a problem. Now I think I'm very much a part of a solution. You know, how much is one American life worth in Iraq to cutting our use on foreign oil? And doing this may lead to, you know, soy biodiesel or other products down the line. You know, I think we really need to look at the big picture here, and everybody focuses in on their one little aspect of this.
Yep.
And we really need to step back and look, okay, it's ethanol now. It might be, I don't know if hydrogen will ever come to be, but there could be something, you know, way beyond what we are thinking about right now.
Don, stick with us. Ian Cheney, there's Don in his combine in the cornfield harvesting right now. What do you say to him? He's pushing back here.
Well, I certainly respect that position, and as we've been talking to some of the farmers in Green that we made the film with, they've said largely the same thing, that they feel very proud to be growing food for alternative fuels. I guess anecdotally, I remember standing on the edge of our acre of corn, looking at it and imagining where it might go, and imagining it going into ethanol, becoming fuel, was a very odd idea because we poured a lot of fuel into that acre to make it grow. The nitrogen fertilizers that we injected into the soil mm-hmm. were made by burning natural gas, and the pesticides are also a petrochemical product. And the just the very mechanization of the entire operation, it felt like we were pouring gasoline in to get ethanol out. And the I think the math on whether it's an efficient process is still up for grabs. And I think he's right to say that it is a kind of a stepping stone. And I think the idea of making ethanol from something like prairie grasses, like what used to grow on our acre of corn, is probably a much more efficient idea in the long run.
Let me ask Don, there in your combine in the cornfield, if you're proud of the corn you bring in, but if we were to change, in what direction would you suggest we change? Is there some change to American policy that you know, from the Iowa farmer's point of view, your point of view, would be economically good and maybe good for our health as well?
Well, you know, as far as the you know, changing the crop, you know, and he brought up about prairie grasses or switchgrass. Nobody even has an idea how we're going to transport that type of stuff to the plants. We as farmers would adapt to a different crop. That, you know, if you can show us profitability, I don't think that would be a problem. However, we've got a lot already in the works and in the pipeline to know how to do this, and we're learning new things every day. And the return from ethanol from growing an acre of corn, and we're getting more efficient every year on the growth of corn, it's been proven it's 1.8 to 1 right now, and it goes up every year. When it started, it was pretty much equal, but that was several years ago. And we haven't grown prairie grass since the ancestors came across the Mississippi River, so I don't really think that's an argument about the prairie.
Been a while. Don, good luck with your harvest there. Thank you very much for joining us. Ricardo Salvador, let me turn to you. You make a brief appearance in King Corn, the documentary. They went out and planted their 1 acre in 2003, before the ethanol boom was really at the high tilt that it's been at in the last couple of years. The premise of the film seems to be, in part, that we grow so much corn, too much corn, that it ended up shoving it down the throats of Americans through all kinds of means in the American diet. Has ethanol changed that? Is ethanol sort of mopping up a lot of that corn that might have gone into, I don't know, Twinkies, and taking it off in a more useful direction now to your way of thinking, or not?
Well, it's difficult to answer questions like that in a spot in time, because in order to really give that a fair treatment, it's important to take the historical view and understand why we've ended up at the point where you can take a slice of time, and that is a sensible question. But if you just want to focus on this slice in time, you get the two antipodal views that were just reflected in the discussion between Don and Ian there. Now, maybe another way of piping in to trying to understand this is that initially, George described very well the conditions that led Wallace and others at the USDA to set up support programs for farmers.
Mm-hmm.
These were successful in various ways and led to a boom in production.
You're talking back in the late 70s, 80s there.
I'm actually reaching back to the 30s to
the farm programs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so we have created some dependencies on systems that were initially installed for completely different purposes than the ones that they are serving right now. So, for instance, it would have been a very strange idea to Secretary of Agriculture Wallace back in the 1930s for him to hear that the programs that he installed today are the programs that are absolutely necessary for global agribusinesses such as the ones that have been cited here to be able to survive, for their business model to be viable. That was not his intention. He was thinking about keeping farmers on the land primarily through control of supply, but with a series of complementary mechanisms. Well, so now we come to this point where essentially through a variety of different streams, the Midwest of the country is an agri-power. It is just churning out maize by bringing in resources from all over the world to do that. Now, if you followed the efforts of people in the Midwest to deal with the glut that is characteristic of overproduction and the cycles, the boom and bust cycles that are characteristic of agriculture, one of the things that has been a constant since since this was organized, you remember hearing George Naylor talk about his being a member of the very first Iowa Corn Promotion Board, is to try to find alternative uses. And there's been a long history of turning corn into a number of different materials, and it's incredibly fungible. This could apply to any number of other crops, but something that is very peculiar, very unique to corn, is that aside from being very fungible, it also is highly productive. It has a particular biological trick that we don't need to get into right now that just makes it particularly productive. And so we have in ethanol probably the very best answer to the question, how can we sop up this excess production? And I think that there are two things that you need to observe about this in the very long-term history of how this boom and bust cycle has gone.
Okay.
One, for reasons that Ian has addressed, is that it is very likely that this is a temporary situation that we're taking a look at right now. As a matter of fact, we're already seeing economic indicators that this is going to be a temporary boom here.
A little softening on the ethanol front.
Mm-hmm. Right. You know, maybe 2 or 3 years.
Yep.
But another thing that has to do with your initial question about sustainability, at the ultimate is essentially the question, how long can we keep this up?
Mm-hmm.
And because of the fact that this system is a way of utilizing fossil fuel, there will have to be some adjustments. We all know, at the very least, we can all agree there will need to be adjustments made within 50 years just because of the nature of the supply of fossil fuel.
Right.
And so here you have a way of sustaining the present system, you know, for another few ticks of the clock. And this is why I mentioned at the outset, if you take a broad historical view, you end up saying very different things than if you're just arguing about what's good for this year's crop.
Ian Cheney, let me ask you, did ethanol sort of boom into the picture after you made the film and change your sense of what's going on? Ricardo Salvador gives us a very long view there, but do you, at least in the nearer term, have the sense that ethanol is going to sop up a lot of that huge corn production and turn it maybe to a different role in the American diet, or not?
Well, I've been reading reports or sort of complaints about in some of the news about higher food prices because the ethanol industry is grabbing more of the corn that's out there, and so the corn processing industry doesn't have enough to turn into high fructose corn syrup and corn fed beef. And I think that's a reason to point out that maybe we don't need all of those corn based foods anyway. Whether or not corn based ethanol is the right thing to do with that corn, making high fructose corn syrup and corn-fed beef isn't necessarily something to fight for. And so with rising food prices, you know, the price of a Little Debbie brownie has just gone up from 25 cents to 35 cents. Rather than fight for that to go back down to 25 cents, maybe we need to question whether we need so many Little Debbie brownies made from corn syrup.
Let me get a call from Danville, Illinois, and Arthur. Hi, Arthur. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful conversation. The question I'd like to propose and see if anybody can answer is the national security issue that all this conversation really revolves around. Here in Illinois, you know, an average size operation is 3,000 to 4,000 acres. We've got 5,000 head dairy operations, mm-hmm. you know, where if a pathogen was to come into that operation, we'd lose our milk supply in this area. The genetics, you know, there's, what, 6 strains of genetics on the planet. If you lose any one of those corn genetics, you know, we could lose them all. You know, cost of producing ethanol actually exceeds the energy that it produces, not to mention the ecological impact of the billions of gallons of water that it takes to produce it, but which brings us to the point that the only reason that ethanol is even being proposed is because it's not free market, it's our tax dollars producing the interest in doing it. And I'd like somebody to, kind of address those national security issues.
Yeah, Arthur, thank you very much. Daryl Ray, there's an organic farmer saying, why is so much of the nation's resources going down this path? Do you see a risk in the kind of homogeneity of the food supply that this produces? And B, of course, the farm bill is on Capitol Hill right now. Is there going to be anything in there that might change the ratio of what's produced in this country, corn to organic and the rest? Daryl.
I think the concern about the homogeneity of genetics is a very real one. Those that have remember the corn leaf blight in the early 1970s remember that it had a tremendous effect because the gene that was affected was in so much of the corn. And as was pointed out, that concern, that risk is probably more serious today than it's ever been, and we have ways of taking care of drought and weather with new varieties that make weather less of a concern. So I think that is a concern, and if it happened, it could be drastic because it could affect such a large proportion of the production. I think that one of the things with ethanol is that, as Ricardo mentioned, farmers have been looking for ways to add value, and many of the ethanol plants were cooperatives to early on, especially, yep. And now they're less so. So there's that, but then there also was the increase in the price of oil, and there was the Iraq War, and so in some ways we had a perfect storm, and then we got an ethanol industry that already has some tax incentives and has import tariffs and put it all together, and you had a pretty substantive economic incentive to produce ethanol. And as has been mentioned, I think that it is part of a process. I don't think corn will be the primary feedstock for liquid fuel over the long run. We probably will move to a different feedstock for ethanol first, and then we'll go to other sources. So it's not a long-run thing.
But a lot of it coming in right now today. There's more here than we can get our arms around in an hour, but it's been a fascinating glimpse of all this. Daryl Ray at the University of Tennessee, thank you very much for joining us today.
Enjoyed it. Thank you.
And Ricardo Salvador there in Battle Creek, Michigan. Ricardo, thank you for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Ian Cheney, it's quite a wonderful documentary in its way. I really do recommend it. It's not all snarky. It's not all bash. There's a lot of empathy here at the same time. Have you changed your diet, Ian?
Trying to avoid corn-fed beef, but it's pretty hard. It's everywhere, and it's pretty tasty.
Well, good luck where you go. Ian Cheney, the documentary is King Corn. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.